And welcome to another episode of the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd, and I'm in the mood to go dun 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 dun. Come on, John.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have totally joined in. Well, the reason we are talking or singing Star Wars tunes is because we have a Star Wars author on tonight, John Jackson Miller, who's the author of Knight Errant, the novel and the comic series. Really love talking to him. Him and Patrick went off for like a half hour about comics, so it's a great interview. So hope you enjoy that. In a couple minutes, we'll run that. We do want to point out. Well, first of all, I am John Anilio. Thanks for joining us. I'm a singer songwriter. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy, and you get a lot of my stuff for free over at johnanilio.bandcamp.com.
And then you can follow him on Twitter at twitter.com/atfmb.
Oh, that's Patrick's hashtag.
Mine. Oh, that's mine? Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. Yes. Sorry.
Gosh. And Patrick is an author who has got lots of projects out there, and you can follow him at ATFMB. Before we get going on the interview, though, we do want to mention that if you're subscribed to the podcast through iTunes, head on over to functionalnerds.com and subscribe to the blog there too, because in addition to the podcast every week, we are having new content on the site every week, and it's starting to build up and it's ramping up a little more each week. So we've had some book reviews, and we've had our booze nerd, and we have a couple of other nerds writing about other things as well. We have a new music review up of the latest Spock's Beard album by Mike Frigetto, or Frigetto. I'm sorry, Mike, if I'm pronouncing your name incorrectly. So that's our first music review up there, so go check that out. I'm a big fan of Spock's Beard, so I was pretty psyched that Mike wanted to write a review for it. So
that actually got a lot of comments just on Twitter, too. I mean, people were like, oh, yeah, hey, I wanted to know if that album was any good, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So we are having new stuff up on the site every week, as well as Patrick and Clifton Hill are doing a webcomic now called Cat Bites. So you will see that up on the Functional Nerds site as well. So,
yep,
you know,
it's actually Tuesdays and Thursdays on catbites.atfmb.com, but Fridays on Functional Nerds.
Yeah, so lots of stuff there, and like we've said the past couple weeks, we are going to try to get new stuff every day. It's not at that point quite yet. It's pretty much every week or a couple times a week, but starting to build it up, so go and check it out. And I may also throw out there, if you are somebody that is a writer or like to maybe write some content for us, you know, let us know. You can, contact us through Twitter or through the site, or, you can email us. I think our emails are both fairly easy to find. If you have an idea for an article that you'd like to write, some sort of nerdy article, let us know. And we're looking for people to contribute. So if you're someone who fancies themselves a writer, let us know, and maybe we can have you write some stuff for us.
Absolutely. And if you're listening to this podcast and you like this podcast, there's a couple things you can do. Number one, go to iTunes. Give us a couple stars. Number two, write a review on iTunes. Number three, tell a friend or two or three. Tell your mom, tell your dad, tell your brother, tell your sister. Help us get some more listeners.
Yeah. So please do that. And we hope you will enjoy this interview with John Jackson Miller. And with us on the line tonight, we have author John Jackson Miller. John Jackson Miller is a comics author as well as a novelist. He has a new novel out called Star Wars Knight Errant, and we are delighted to have him on the show tonight. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, welcome. Glad to be here.
I did look at your bio, and just before we actually started recording, I had mentioned that I noticed that you did write the Knights of the Old Republic graphic novels, and I didn't realize that until I was finished with the book. Knight Errant is your first novel, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I've been writing Star Wars related stuff for about, I guess, we're going on to 6 years here. I started with just a single issue of Star Wars Empire back in 2005, and that followed. I had previously written other comics. I wrote Iron Man for a year, Crimson Dynamo, wrote an issue of The Simpsons, But Star Wars was something I'd always wanted to do, and that first issue led to a whole bunch of issues of Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. I wrote that series for a little over 4 years, 50 issues.
Wow.
works out to be about four, or actually works out to 9 graphic novels over the course of 4 years. And in there, I also did some other things for Lucasfilm, including, I wrote a campaign guide for the role-playing game.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was the Knights of the Old Republic campaign guide, and if you've got one, it's worth a lot of money right now. it was one of those where, I think the demand was a lot greater than the supply, so, that book is running about 200 hours on Amazon right now, so wow. I'm hoping they'll come out with another role-playing game system here at some point, and we can start doing some more for that. But I did that, and I also did some short stories for the Star Wars website. That led to an opportunity writing a series of ebooks for Del Rey. That's a series called Lost Tribe of the Sith, which we can discuss later because that's still going and there's new episodes of that coming out. Somewhere in all this, we decided to end Knights of the Old Republic, start a brand new comic series called Knight Errant. I was contacted around then when we were working on that with the idea of, well, let's also do a novel as well, and I'll write both the comic series and the novel, and it'll integrate really well. It won't be, the novel is not an adaptation of the comics or vice versa. They're two different things, but we wanted to do something where you don't have to have read one to enjoy the other, but hopefully people will want to get into more about it, and they'll find their way from one to the other.
You know what's interesting about that? That's strange because, LucasArts, they don't seem to do very well with, cross-platform promotion. You never see them do that kind of stuff.
Well, this was a little bit different. We've had some things like that in the past. I mean, I think the big one everybody knows about is apart from the movie adaptations. The big one everybody knows about is, Shadows of the Empire, where Yeah, they had novel, they had comics, they had video games.
Yes, I remember that.
And I think in this case, I think what was a little bit different here is that I was, I was one person behind everything, and I was conceptualizing both at the same time. I was also involved with all the supporting materials that have come out. We did a short story that's available on StarWars.com. That serves as an introduction for both the novel and the comics. That's still available on there for free. I worked with the guys, Dan Wallace and Jason Fry, that do the Star Wars Atlas to come up with an Atlas supplement that is also available for free on StarWars.com, showing where all of the, places that we visit in the Knight Errant, world is. So I got a chance to, put my, imprint a little bit on everything that we were doing. So I guess that is a bit of a difference in that, it wasn't something where the comics came first really and the novel came later. Yes, that was the case in terms of, I started working on the comics first and then the novel came along. But since I was working on them both simultaneously, I was able to cross-fertilize ideas from both and, kind of make a decision as I was writing the comics, hey, this would be a better idea for the novel or vice versa.
That's actually very cool.
Yeah. Now, John, what I'd like to do is maybe back up a little bit and, because I know that you've been writing comics for quite a while. And I wonder if you can, because we've had a lot of authors on the show and a lot of science fiction and fantasy authors who write comics and write novels. Quite a few that we talked to, believe it or not, got started writing novels first and then wrote comics because comics is such a difficult field to break into in terms of everything, but particularly the writing. So maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about how you got started in writing in the field of comics in general?
Well, I've been a comics fan since practically birth. I started collecting comics when I was 6 years old, and I started writing my own comics and drawing them at the same time. I still have a lot of the old, mimeographed comics that I did way back then. And I think that, I also learned to write, prose at the same time. But it was just something where I always had that dual skill set going on. I went on to a career in journalism. With a couple of side trips, I ended up as the editor of the trade magazine for the comic book industry from 1993 to almost for about 10 years. I was the editor of Comics and Games Retailer Magazine, which was the trade magazine's sister publication to Comics Buyer's Guide, which is the long-running newspaper and magazine. And I worked at that company both, on the trade side and the consumer side. I wrote a series of books, collectible price guides for them as well. And so it was, I think, in 2002, at the end of that year, that I was approached by Marvel, saying, "Hey, would you like to, take a shot at writing a plot?" And
when they picked you up off the floor.
this was one of those things where it was actually part of a talent contest that Marvel had been running. That was the Epic Comics line that they had. It lasted for about my series and half of another one before it went away. But mine was the first one that got picked out of a whole lot. I remember going to visit the offices there in Marvel, and they had the submissions piled up along three walls. And that was actually part of what brought that to a premature end, is there was just too much for them to handle. I was part of for the very first wave. They went to people who were known figures in the comics world that just had never written comics before. And solicited ideas from all of us. And I made that first cut, and then, bizarrely, I ended up being the only book that came out and actually completed its run. And that was Crimson Dynamo, based on the Iron Man villain.
Sure.
That was a case where, one of my side trips in my career I got some use out of, because I have a master's degree in Soviet studies. And that's pretty useless in today's world.
unless you go down and you visit with Yakov and Branson.
Branson, yeah. Well, I tell you, it has turned out to be useful both there, in the comics, in those Crimson Dynamo comics, and then of course I'm also writing about these totalitarian states in this Knight Errant series and novel. So I guess I got some use out of it, but I did that, and that led to Iron Man, and then Iron Man led us to Star Wars.
Nice.
That's great. It's funny you mentioned that they asked you to write something with plot. I actually got into comics way later in life. I was in college when I started with comics, and I read one of my roommate had these all the Marvel Handbook to the Universe, those volumes, and he just had them all in his room, and I just started reading through them, and I got really into reading these handbooks to the universe. And after a month or two of that, he's like, "You should really read something with plot."
that would be helpful.
He's like, "If you like reading these, you'll like the plot too."
No, that's great. And there are, I'm so happy that there are all these people out there that are willing to be encyclopedists and figure out all that stuff and get it all recorded, so I don't have to go read everything that's out there. I think that's an interesting way to get at it.
And I think it is kind of, it's a good sort of advertisement for the actual comics, because you can sort of read and get you know, educated on the world and the characters a little bit before you just kind of, you know, because I think one of the problems that comics have quite often when you have these ongoing series, and I think why it's sometimes hard to get new readers, is because, you know, many of these books have been going on for years and years. And I think a lot of people just feel very overwhelmed by sort of getting into the story midstream. So I think those things like the Handbooks to the Universe is kind of a good primer for getting people into the actual comics.
Well, that's true. I calculate a lot of information about, you know, comics history. The one, you know, remnant I have from my career on the journalism side, I run a website called the Comics Chronicles. That's comicron.com, where, you know, one of the things I do is I have all the sales figures for most of the comics ever, and I they're all sitting out in my garage, and they've got to go somewhere. So I put this stuff online every so often when I get a chance. But, you know, one of the things that I figured out one day was that, you know, there had been something like 24,000 different DC comic books something like 19,000 Marvel comic books. And they're all considered canon. They're all considered part of the history. That's a lot to keep in mind. That's a lot to remember. You know, Star Wars is, you would say it's a little easier because it's just six movies plus, well, there are other movies like the Clone Wars movies, and then there were the Ewoks movies, and than everything else. But that's the thing, is that everything else counts. You know, they have this idea of the expanded universe where, you know, whatever happens to the characters in novels or comics or, you know, video games or, you know, whatever is in role-playing game handbooks, that all counts. That information is part of the characters' biographies. And so that does make it a little bit more challenging. But still, it's not quite like having 24,000 comic books out there to worry about.
Are the Han Solo adventures considered by Brian Daley, or are those considered canon?
Yes, they are.
Wow, I did not know that.
Basically, I think, you know, the real effort, you know, there were some efforts by the creators in the early 80s to, you know, keep an eye on what each other were doing. And, you know, occasionally they would name drop something from something somebody else was doing. And certainly you also had Lucasfilm, you know, they had their people there who were, you know, looking at everything that was coming in and saying, okay, you shouldn't do this because this is also being done over here. Or, you know, this is too close to what's going to happen someplace else, like in the movies. And they would, make changes. But it really, I don't think it really isn't until you get into the 1990s where, you know, the decision is made that everything counted, everything is going to be integrated. Furthermore, you know, the fans were helpful with this. We're going to find a way out. We're going to find out a way to make sure that everything that ever happened also integrates as well. Now, some things are just impossible to deal with, but some of the things that just don't, you know, sync up properly.
Like the Christmas special?
Well, I mean, parts of, you know, Life Day, the existence of Life Day is that's canon. Chewbacca's son, you know, there you go. That's where he comes from. That's where Boba Fett comes from. These things are part of the tapestry. The fans want things to work. They want things to, you know, count. They want them to be included, but sometimes there are, you know, challenges to making that happen. And I've written about this before. I always try to make sure that I can, if I'm confronted with two different possible, you know, things, or if I create something that causes a problem, I try to figure out a way to make both versions work. You'll have things like, in the Marvel comics when they didn't know what Jabba the Hutt was going to look like, they had Jabba looking like a monkey. I don't know if you remember seeing that. That was way back when. They decided that this was just a guy who was using Jabba's name. But it was one of Jabba's henchmen. I like ideas like that. I've done that myself. I call it like chefs do when they say you can eat your mistakes if something doesn't go right. I like trying to come up with ideas where, if I'm confronted with two different possible explanations for what happened, if there's a way, instead of retconning and say, oh, this thing never happened, they both happened. You just saw it from the wrong angle.
Right. You know, that reminds me of the Star Trek comic books, because Marvel had Star Wars for the longest time. DC had Star Trek.
That's right.
And they had Star Trek when the original crew was still making movies.
Right.
And so their, you know, Paramount's opinion was that the movies were canon and the comic books were not.
And this is the problem for everybody trying to figure out these things retroactively.
Right. But what would happen is, you know, you would have Spock dies in Star Trek II. Well, that, of course, throws the whole comic book off. And so they go off on the new adventures and the new voyages, and they start doing all this other stuff. And then Star Trek III comes out and Spock's back. So now in the comic book, they try to get them to a point where it seems like, you know, it fits now with the new movie.
It syncs up, yeah. And you know, this is part of the fun of being a fan, is figuring out how all this stuff works. Because you know, honestly, if you were to try to, and I'm sure there are people doing it. You know, there's a Wikipedia for Star Trek called Memory Alpha, where they're trying to figure out how everything fits together.
Yep.
At some point, you've got to go back and deal with those Gold Key comics from the 60s, where, you know, they actually farmed out the art to a guy in Italy who had never seen the show. Yep. And you've got, you know, fire coming out of the back of the Enterprise's nacelles. Somebody will have to come up with the explanation for why that looked that way that's in canon. I think that'll be fun.
Well, if you look at some of the original art from Marvel for Star Wars, it was terrible. They didn't look anything like the characters. I don't think they had secured licensing on the likenesses yet.
Well, they actually had. There's a very interesting article in Star Wars Insider 122 that has just come out, where they actually have the audio tape of Howard Chaykin meeting with George Lucas and Charlie Lippincott.
Oh, wow.
And they discuss likenesses. Likeness rights are not a problem. It's just, you know, Howard was trying to shape some of these characters into the way that he wanted, them to look. Now, it's true that they didn't have photography on a whole lot of stuff. They didn't know what a lot of the, you know, a lot of the things were going to look like, and possibly he wouldn't have known what some of the other characters were going to look like. But you know, that was such a surreal episode anyway, because, you know, the book was, you know, that, you know, what, 2.5 issues of that, 3 issues of it came out before the movie did.
Yeah. And in fact, that's one of the first comic books I ever owned.
Yeah. Star Wars number one is the first Marvel comic book I ever bought.
Yep.
And it was in that 3-pack that you would get from Walgreens. Which again, takes me back to my, you know, collector, you know, writing days, because, you know, I that was one of my missions, was to find out how many different versions of that comic book existed. And I wrote an article on that for Overstreet a couple of years ago.
Well, Marvel always did that, though. They would always reprint issues and put them in those little packs. And so, like, one side would be G.I. Joe, the other side would be Transformers.
Well, that was one of the fun things. And again, this probably gets us off into the weeds here, but one of the things that I wrote about for Overstreet is that, you know, for years, people thought that those bagged editions, those 3-packs, were all reprints. And in fact, most of the Star Wars ones were reprints. They also did reprints for G.I. Joe, as you say.
Wolverine.
The reprints that they did were pretty much mostly these licensed books. The toy books, because the idea was they were going to do huge runs of them and sell them in the toy stores. But actually, if you go and look at, back issue bins, you'll find that there are a lot of these comics that have the different, you know, the diamond-shaped logo on them from the late 70s. Those were just regular Marvel comics that were sold in 3-packs by a company called Whitman. Whitman was actually, you know, part of the company that produced the Gold Key comics. In the 1970s, when comic book circulation was collapsing in newsstands, Whitman came up with the idea of, well, we will do a secondary run of these comics. We'll print them at the exact same time. We'll bag them 3 for 99 cents. And sell them in places that don't carry magazines, Walgreens and Kmart and you know, all of those kinds of places that never had any, you know, never had any comic book sales in single issue form.
Right.
And so those books are actually not reprints. We went back and I talked with Jim Shooter about that at Chicago last year. Those were simultaneous printings. They just changed the black plate. And in fact, there's a version of the DC Comics from that time that they did with the same, they did the same thing with. They actually have a Whitman logo on the cover instead of the DC logo. They didn't do that with Marvel. They just changed the trade dress on the front of it. But, you know, for years and years, retailers were saying, oh, that's just a reprint. Well, no, the Star Wars stuff is mostly reprint because they printed a million copies of those books.
Wow.
And in fact, it was the first million copy seller since 1960. It literally saved the comics industry. Shooter has said it saved Marvel. And, you know, saving Marvel probably saves the comics industry. Again, I'm way off the subject.
No, it's okay. We do this all the time. And I know John's dying to ask you about the book, and here I am talking to you about comic books. One last question, and then I'll let John ask you about the novel. You brought to mind another name that I had forgotten, which is the Overstreet Comic Book Buyer's Guide.
Yeah.
Is that still being published?
Well, there's two different publications here. The Overstreet Comics Price Guide.
Right.
Yeah, that is the book. It comes out from Gemstone Press. It comes out every year in, I think now they have them coming out, you know, during San Diego Comic-Con. I'm one of the Overstreet advisors, and you know, that still is, you know, I think it's in its 41st year.
That needs to be online with a subscription.
Well, they've done various things, you know, various times looking at that, again, having done, you know, these price guides for Comics Buyer's Guide, you know, we found a number of challenges, which is that, you know, databases that are designed to print out books are not always great for actually, you know, searching on the internet and sure. Vice versa.
Sure.
When I was at Comics Buyer's Guide, I edited a line of comic price guides called the Standard Catalog of Comic Books. And we basically did our version of Overstreet, except we had individual line items for every issue. So it was checklisted. And, you know, instead of saying issues 1 through 6, $5, it was issue 1, $5, issue 2, $5. And these were giant books. They're just doorstops of a book. I mean, I think the last one we did was 1,600 pages.
Oh, yeah, they all are. I mean, even the Overstreet is huge.
Yeah, Overstreet's about 1,000. Yeah.
It's 1,000 with a 0.6
tiny
font.
Type, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And when we did that, we actually did that series of books in conjunction with a company called Comic Base, which is a CD-ROM platform or a DVD-ROM platform where, you know, you save your collection on there. And you know, enter what you've got, and so that, you know, we had a DVD version of the book, and vice versa. Yeah, since then I'm no longer with that company, but the comic based people do have what you're talking about in the form of a product called Atomic Avenue, where it's all online like that. But Comics Buyer's Guide, the magazine, is still going as well. That's a monthly magazine. It used to be a newspaper. And that's in year 40 at this point as well, too. So those are some long-running products.
See, the one thing that I've always wanted to do is be able to have, you know, a database of my comic books.
Well, I think I would recommend, since a lot of me is in it, the Comic Base product. My collection is in it. I have 45,000 comic books. If there's ever a fire, I pretty much know what I've got. I got a pile of ashes.
So John, now that the other John and I have talked about comic books for 20 minutes, did you have anything else you wanted to ask?
Oh, I did. Yeah. I'm sorry. Anyway, I had lots of stuff I wanted to ask about the book.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry. I took over.
No. I'm glad you did. I very much enjoyed the book, and I have not read the comics, and it does stand alone as a novel. And one of the things that I really liked about Knight Errant is your development of the Sith characters in the book. And I don't want to really talk about it too much because I would be giving a lot away. But I really loved how it's sort of each new Sith Lord that was sort of brought into the story just was more powerful, or just a really interesting take on the Sith characters. And I wanted to know, are these all characters that you created, John, or were some of these characters from other stories and other comics and such? So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the Sith characters that are in the Knight Errant novel.
And then I have a follow-up Sith question after that.
Sure thing. I created all of them. In fact, I created pretty much everything that's in this corner of the time frame. The Knights of the Knight Errant setting is 1,000 years before the Phantom Menace, and so it's about a generation before the nearest thing in Star Wars continuity. Those being the novels by Drew Karpyshyn with Darth Bane in them. In those novels, there are scads and scads of Sith Lords. Darth Bane kills everybody, so there's only two left. And that institutes the rule of two that we're familiar with the Emperor and Darth Vader. I wanted to write about this period that was beforehand, where, again, we have all these different Sith Lords, and they're all vying for the right to, be top dog and, take the fight to the Republic. The Republic is pretty much curled up into a fetal position at this point. They're not offering any defense. They pulled all the Jedi back to, guard the borders. What we have in our storyline is we have a young knight, Kara Holt, who becomes our knight errant, because she travels with a group of weekend warrior Jedi to, try and, make a difference out here fighting these Sith Lords. The mission goes wrong. She ends up stranded. And she decides, I'm going to stay. I came out here to try and improve people's lives. That's what I'm going to do. But what she finds is that this is a very challenging thing because, again, there's this patchwork crazy quilt of, little empires run by different Sith overlords. And pretty much all you've got to do to become a Sith Lord is say, hi, I'm a Sith Lord, put on a hat, and, you're there. The only qualification is surviving. The way that I decided to come at it, as far as her story was concerned, it's a lot like Homer's Odyssey. She goes from one realm to another, and we see these strange peoples and these strange societies that have been built to prop up these Sith Lords and their deranged ideas of how society should work. This is always going to be the challenge with the Sith is, their whole, shtick is, it's all about me and you guys are all nothing. It's all about the elevation of the individual and, the suppression of everybody else. Well, unless you're Palpatine in the movies who figures out how to get a bunch of people to, buy that, why would anybody, work for you? Why would, how would you actually have a kingdom? How would you have a society? I would just normally expect everybody else to say, oh, well, that's Fred. He's the Sith. He, just stay away from him. He's just going to be muttering in the corner. Don't listen to him. What I came up with was the idea that every one of these guys has a different take on Sith philosophy, a different, angle on, how they're supposed to act and what their relationship with the Force is and how that's going to lead them to victory. And then I have their madness sort of play out throughout the society. This takes me back to the whole Soviet studies thing where, I was looking at different totalitarian states and how, a lot of it was based on various people believing in conflicting ideas or ideas that conflicted with reality in some cases. That's what we've got here. I mean, we've got a Sith Lord named Daemon who is convinced that he is the creator of the universe and that everybody else that exists is just in his imagination. We have his brother, Odian, who believes he's destined to be the destroyer of the universe. The mere existence of other mortals gives him a real headache through the Force, and he has, crafted his society around this entire suicide cult of his that he wants everybody to cash in his service. There are other figures like that as well where, and some of them are quite tragic, I think, that you know, they have you know, taken, you know, some portion of Sith philosophy to an extreme, and there's this clash of empires. These guys are doing more damage to the people that, you know, live underneath them by fighting each other than they could ever do to the Republic. They're warring amongst themselves, and, you know, that's where Kara Holt comes in, to try to save some of the few people that she can.
Yeah, I really, you know, appreciated that about this novel was just, and I like how you made the Odyssey reference to it, because I was thinking that myself, how in each you know, new section of the book, it introduces a new Sith Lord. And, you know, I was every time it went to a new section, I was surprised. It was like having another new book to read almost. And then it was tied up quite nicely at the end. So it was really a joy to read, because it was more than I expected, because I it starts, as you said, with Damon and Odian, and I just expected, like, all right, these are the Sith guys in this book, and, you know, we'll see how this plays out through it. And then to have even more interesting Sith Lords introduced, you know, throughout the book. And also just I really just enjoyed the sort of the mythology behind each one, and their sort of own like you said, relationship with the Force and how they sort of operated within it. And it was, I think it really takes advantage of what's going on or what can be done within the Star Wars universe while having kind of a unique take on it. John DiNardo, who is the head of SF Signal, and Patrick helps them do a podcast as well. SF Signal is a science fiction blog. And we talk about Star Wars once in a while. And anytime we mention Star Wars, John DiNardo and I are always saying how, you know, it's such a big universe, there should be lots of stuff going on all the time. Like, we were talking about it in terms of, like, TV shows and movies. Like, why aren't there right now three or four different Star Wars TV shows on? And why isn't there, you know, new Star Wars movies taking place in these different time, you know, time frames? And I think Knight Errant is an excellent example of what could be done in the Star Wars universe apart from, you know, just the main, you know, what the movies have done. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
I think it's a different flavor. Mm-hmm. You know, we have these different sectors of the timeline where if you are interested in, you know, a place where, you know, the Republic is robust and the Sith are basically non-existent, well, then you've got the early Knights of the Old Republic period. If you want the Republic and the Sith empires to be, you know, on pretty much even terms, well, you know, then you've got the Old Republic, you know, video game time frame. If you're looking for, you know, something where the Sith are running roughshod, you know, you've got Knight Errant. We've have all these different, you know, varieties out there. And, you know, I think that you know, various people are attracted to different kinds.
That's a good segue into my question about the Sith.
Sure.
So you've got Darth Bane, who brings it down to the master-apprentice rule. You know, just the two.
Right.
And that goes all the way up to the point, you know, in the prequels where Yoda says, you know, there's only ever two, you know,
right,
a master and an apprentice, and that's it. But that's not true, because really you've got Darth Sidious, you've got Lord Tyrannus, you've got Darth Maul, you've got Ventress, you've got Anakin kind of coming up. So really there's more than just the two Sith. I mean, even when it's like you've got Palpatine and Count Dooku. Dooku is looking at Palpatine as his master, even though Palpatine had Darth Maul.
Right.
Somebody had to teach Dooku to be a Sith. And then Dooku goes off and teaches Ventress.
Well, these are some of the great mysteries of the universe.
and then you jump to Legacy. And in Legacy, you know, all of a sudden there's just a billion Sith popping up out of the woodwork.
Well, the rule of two, I would presume, by Legacy is done.
Well, he even says that, I mean, he confronts the spirit of Darth Bane at one point and says, you know, screw you, the rule of two is stupid.
Yeah. I think it's interesting there, you know, exactly how attached they are to the rule of two by the later time. It's hard to say. But, you know, that kind of came about, though, you know, way back when they decided that, you know, the Emperor would have assassins. the Emperor's Hand.
Mara Jade, right.
Yeah, and you know, even going back to Lumia, who was the Shira Bree character from the Marvel comics.
Yes. Oh yeah. I remember her.
Yeah,
she
David
dressed
Michelinie.
Like Vader.
Yeah, that was a great storyline. I think the where we've kind of found room for these things is we've got other classes of guys, like you'll call them Sith adepts. They're people who study, but aren't necessarily in the hierarchy.
So they're force sensitive.
And there's all kinds of force sensitive people, so they don't all necessarily have to be Jedi. So we have that, and of course, with the Lost Tribe of the Sith series, we've got Sith coming out of our ears over there. So that's that, and that's a different flavor entirely as well, because that's a realm where there are only Sith and there are no Jedi whatsoever. And that's this short story series that I've been doing, and that we've announced is going to be collected into a novel with some new material from me next summer.
Wow.
2012. Oh.
Great. Well, and that's what I wanted to ask is that, with Knight Errant out now and the novel and the comics, what can we expect from this universe? More obviously, the comics will be ongoing. Is there going to be more novels? What's kind of coming up within that series?
Well, it's been announced that there will be another Star Wars Knight Errant comics arc. We've been doing these things 5-issue arcs at a time. With some time off in between, the next arc is slated for 2011. Here, Dark Horse hasn't specifically announced when it's going to be, but I'm hard at work on that, and I've seen some of the ship designs for it. It's just outstanding. It's going to be really cool. As far as Knight Errant Prose in the future, nothing has been said or announced on that. Certainly, I would love to do more. Then with regard to other stuff I have coming out in the Star Wars realm, again, as I say, we have Lost Tribe of the Sith. The sixth short story for that just went live here this week.
And those are ebooks.
Those are ebooks. They're short stories that are available for download at StarWars.com, also on Kindle and Barnes & Noble's Nook, and also the Sony e-reader. These are short stories that follow the history of the group of Sith that turns up in the Fate of the Jedi novels. This is a little deserted planet that has had Sith living there for 5,000 years. They crashed 5,000 years ago, and have created this society that has survived.
And let me guess, and it's all rainbows and bunny rabbits.
It's a mess. I've been writing this, and I've already jumped forward 1,000 years. We go to a new cast of characters, and we jump a little bit further every time we do them. I think my model for this has kind of been Asimov and the Foundation trilogy, mm-hmm. where you have different castes and different groups of people that show how the society has evolved.
Sure.
The storyline that I just completed is actually kind of funny, because it's the closest thing I think anybody's going to find to a Sith Harlequin romance. And it deals with the issues of, how does romance actually work when it's all about me and it's not about you? How do families work with the Sith? I mean, this is all kind of, I always ask how. We have all these great ideas, and I look at the things and say, how did this come about? How did we get from the Sith that would have crash landed on this planet to this orderly society that we have that's in the novels? And so that's what the Lost Tribe of the Sith is. And again, Yeah, those are free downloads. We will have two more that will be coming out for free over the next year. And then, as I say, in 2012, I'll be gathering that all together with a substantial amount of new material. And so that should feel like a new novel for everybody.
Great. You know, and you mentioned one thing that sort of triggered something for me is you mentioned the ship designs. And I read a blog post that you had about using Legos to build the ships. And I wanted to, and I know it's kind of like off track a little bit, but I found that article so interesting, and I totally forgot about it until you mentioned the ship design. So maybe you could tell everybody a little bit about your use of Legos while writing.
Well, when I've got the comic books, I've got these talented artists who are able to come up with designs that are better than I could imagine. But when I was writing the novel, in particular, I had a single spaceship that was going to be pretty important to a lot of scenes. This was a vessel that was a hybrid. It was an artillery carrier that was grafted onto a cruise liner. And I always wanted to know, what does this thing look like? I'm going to have a lot of scenes here. And so I took my initial idea, and my son and I sat down with my 11-year-old son, and I sat down with our big pile of Legos, and we just built the thing. And we realized, the way this thing looks, it has a hard time standing up. And I said, that's going to be part of the story. It has a hard time standing up. and they're always having problems with the hydraulic supports. The fact that it was ungainly and everything gave it some personality. It really is one of the additional stars of the book, I think. Because I had that, I decided, well, let's get that out so somebody can see what it looks like. And the folks at StarWars.com were happy to put it up there, because, Legos, it's a Star Wars licensee. So that all works. If I had used some off-brand of bricks, that wouldn't have worked. Mega Bloks couldn't have done that.
Well, I'll have to I do some work for Wired.com, their Geek Dad blog. I do a music video series for them, and Legos come up on the Geek Dad blog almost daily, and Star Wars comes up pretty regularly too. So I'll have to hook you up with those guys, because I think they would love to hear about your sort of using the Legos with your son to do the shipbuilding for the novel. So I just thought that was so interesting, and I'll have to tell the Geek Dad guys about that. So
sounds great.
Great. So anything else coming out before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I have another comic series coming out simultaneously with Knight Errant. We have the second series of Mass Effect comics, Mass Effect based on the video game by BioWare. That's a series where I am scripting the comics based on plots that I'm working out with Mac Walters, who is lead writer on the game. And we did a set of those comics in the beginning of last year, same time that the video game came out. Those sold out immediately. We had to go to a second printing, which isn't very common for comics. And that resulted in another series this year called Mass Effect Evolution, which tells the origin story of a character called the Elusive Man, who is a major figure in the video games. I think that Martin Sheen actually plays the voice of the character. So I wish we could get Martin Sheen in to record an audio track for the comic book. I think that would be
that would be awesome.
That would be awesome. But yeah, I have that, and I have some other various irons in the fire. And
If you could get him to record it, then you use the technology from the greeting cards, and when people open up the comic book, he just starts speaking.
That'd be cool. Or maybe they're doing all these ebook comics for the iPad or whatever. Let's just go ahead and add an audio track. Hey, it's all good to me.
I think you might have a hard time getting Martin Sheen, but you might be able to get Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, or Emilio. I mean, Emilio would do it.
Emilio Estevez, yes. Hey, and I just want to throw out there that Dark Horse has always been one of my favorite companies. I really liked the early stuff that they started the Star Wars stuff with, you know, like Dark Empire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was great.
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, between Dark Horse and everybody else, they really have, I think, done something important with this whole expanded universe concept and working so closely with the licensor to make sure that the things that we're doing count. You know, for so many years, as we were discussing, you know, the comics were just one more licensed product. I mean, they might as well be a T-shirt in yep. terms of the relevance that they had. Now, I think everybody's looking at these things as, yeah, this is all part of our world building. This is all part of our outreach. And other people are doing it as well. I mean, Mass Effect, which we've been talking about, has the exact same concept. Mm-hmm. What happens in these comics happens.
Marvel did okay with the Star Wars line. In the early days, it was kind of rough, but towards the end, it got a little, you know, it got better.
Yeah.
But I just don't think that they approached it the same way that Dark Horse has. And Dark Horse, obviously, embraced it, and they have ran with it, and they've done some great things. And I say obviously because they still have it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, Dark Horse had already, I think, been doing something like this with Aliens.
Right. Yeah, they had Aliens and Predator, and
you know that stuff was so that stuff was so phenomenal. You know, the movies came from it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's something where, yeah, I think that comic books, and obviously I'm you know pretty heavily invested in comics if I've spent my whole life on it, and you know I'm running this website at the same time. I think that comics really are the sort of the creative engine for so much of what's out there. And I think it's because, in part because we are a visual form of literature, and you know, we are able to inspire both, you know, the imagination, you know, verbally and visually, and the startup to actually, you know, putting a comic book out is not that big. I mean, the barriers to entry cannot be really high when we've got 300 or 400 comic books coming out every month. and yeah, they're not all gems, but I mean, good Lord. You know, I think Walking Dead alone had like a 2% market share last year. And this is just, you know, this is a comic book that is not from you know, a major corporation. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got movies coming out that are based on, you know, all sorts of creator owned properties as well. Yeah, the publishers have a role in here too. But I think that, you know, we really are. I think that we're the early adopters, I think, of new ideas. You know, the people that are willing to go into the comic shop and, you know, pay what is essentially, you know, the same amount of money that they would pay if they were to buy the trade paperback later on. But these people are willing to go in there every week so that they see it first.
Yep.
And so they can be part of that pilot group, that focus group that winnows things out, sees things before anybody else does, and is able to say, hey, you know, Watchmen, seen it 20 years ago.
You know, I avoid comic book stores these days simply because I am an impulse buyer.
So yeah, I think that we have a core group of people out there that really want to be really want to be the vanguard of pop culture, and they know this is where to be. I mean, as I like I say, hey, Watchmen, yeah, issue 12, that was four weeks late. I remember that. What's that DVD there, buddy? Nah, come on, I was there at the beginning.
I just wanted to throw out there that I remember when comic books were 45 cents.
Were they ever 45 cents, or maybe in Canada?
No, they were 45 cents.
No, we went from 40 to 50. They were 35 once.
I thought they were 45. I remember 45 cent comic.
Oh, you don't want to hear me do this.
Okay, but my point was that, you know, you go out yeah, now and they're like $4.
Sorry, I'm pulling geek rank here.
That's okay.
No. So, 10 cents, 12 cents, 15 cents, 20 cents, 25 cents, 30 cents, 35 cents, 40 cents, 50 cents, 60 cents, 65 cents, 75 cents, 95 cents, $1, $1.25, $1.50, $2, $1.99. Yeah, that's actually the price increases over the last 40 years. Yeah, wow. No, I'm sorry. I
should never have challenged the guy who worked for Overstreet.
I should be institutionalized. There's no use for this information. There really is. I mean, although I will tell you, it is fun because doing that website. I'll get calls and emails from companies that are working on revivals of things that came out 20, 30, 40 years ago. And they'll say, how well did this sell? and I'll say, I'm sorry, what, Logan's Run? Well, okay, yes, came out in 1977. And I'm able to come up with some numbers for them. But I love that we have that much history that's out there and that people can actually say, you know, what comics fans did 30 years ago, they might still do today. I love that idea.
Yeah. Well, let's, we're getting near the end of our time. So John, thanks so much for coming on the show. Why don't you, to wrap it up, why don't you give us your website and, any kind of social media, if you're on Twitter and all that kind of stuff, so our listeners can check you out a little more.
Sure thing. The main personal website is farawaypress.com. My Twitter feed for that is JJM Faraway. I am on Facebook at facebook.com/John Jackson Miller. And then of course the comics history website, that's Comicron, Comichron.com.
Great. Fantastic. Well, John, thanks so much for joining us. Next time you have something out that you want to come and talk about, please come on. I'm sure you and Patrick can geek out about comics.
Yeah, now I want to ask him about the blog Comics Should Be Good.
Well, I've seen it.
Well, maybe we can get John on the SF Signal podcast, too, and you guys can go off for a long time on that one. So very good. Thanks so much, John.
You're welcome.
And we're back. So I hope you enjoyed that interview and Patrick and John's talk about comics. I think they could have kept going all night, which is great. And we'll definitely have to have him back on the show or over at the SF Signal podcast to talk more comics. Great guy, super nice guy. Happy to have him on the show. Go check out his book. I got to say, I really liked Knight Errant quite a bit. It started off as a fairly straight ahead Star Wars novel, but really it really gripped me as it went on. It definitely got better as it went along. Lots of little twists and turns and surprises along the way. So if you like Star Wars, I think this is a great addition to the Star Wars catalog of novels. So go and check that out. Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
Over on atfmb.com, I've started a writer's journal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've paid any attention to that.
I did see that today. I didn't get a chance to.
It's not every day.
Mm-hmm.
So, it jumps from like day one to day five to day 10 or something like that. It's just whenever something, occurs to me as far as writing goes, I'm writing these. And they can be kind of abstract a little bit, and sometimes they're a little bit more focused. Like I just wrote one about, essentially backing up your writing. And because I'm faced with an iMac right now that could die due to a graphics card problem or logic board problem, I'm not sure which. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of was taking a look at backing up and doing, where do you keep your writing? And, you don't want to ever lose anything. So I just wrote this kind of long post about that. And then I also did manage to leap ahead on word count on my novel. So I'm at, I'm rewriting it completely now. I don't know if I told you that.
Yeah, you did. So hopefully that'll go well for you.
I'm at 24,000 words now. So that was kind of a cool little jump forward. We've got Cat Bites with Clifton Hill. He's drawing that. I'm writing that. That's kind of amusing to me. Some people are already amused to see a cartoony version of myself in that mm-hmm. comic. I'm actually writing the character to be different than me. In many different ways. So although it looks like me and it's based on me and it's based on my cat and conversations with my cat, it is going to be different. So that's going on. Podcasting 101 over on Grasping for the Wind, SF Signal podcast stuff going on, cool stuff happening there. Trying to think if there's anything else kind of cool that I'm forgetting about. I did a new video for Geek Dad. Oh, wait, no, that's you.
Oh yeah, I do have a new video for Geek Dad that should be out by the time this airs. I also, if you're really interested in hearing me blather on forever, I actually was interviewed for the Force 925 radio show, which is actually a podcast right now as well. That's out of Canada with Julia Sherrod. She interviewed me for like 2.5 hours. So
wow, it's holy crap.
So if you want to hear me blather on more than normal, go and check that out. I'm sure I'll post that up somewhere. But it was really great fun to chat with Jules.
Are all her episodes that long?
Yeah, well, she interviewed Paul and Storm the week before me, that interview was like 3 hours. So it's
wow,
long form.
Holy crap, dude.
But if you're kind of interested in some of the stuff that I do kind of get into depth about how I got started doing all this stuff, and I do talk about functional nerds quite a bit on it as well. So it's a definitely interesting listen if you have the stamina for it. I also have, hopefully by the time this airs, I'll have it out, but I have a new EP that I'm putting out. I did the Angry Robot podcast theme song. Angry Robot is a publisher in the UK that our friend Mer Lafferty does the podcast for, and Mer had asked me to do.
So you did a theme for them?
I did a theme for them, yes. And I know I still owe us.
Who else have you done theme songs for?
Lots of people, but not ours.
So like SF Signal?
Yes.
Yeah, and you did the Good Cop, Bad Cop for Murr.
Yeah, I should be writing for Murr.
You did I Should Be Writing. And
yes.
Well, you do a lot of theme songs for podcasts, don't you?
I do. Yeah, you would think I would have done one for our own by now, but I have not.
Yeah, just not for us. Okay. Yeah, yeah, I see how you are now.
Sorry about that. But anyway, eventually it'll happen someday. I did the theme song, and I really liked the Angry Robot theme song that I did. And I had intentions of writing a full song, and I just, couldn't come up with anything. And it sat there for a while, and I've gotten to be pretty good friends with Matt Forbeck, who is an author for Angry Robot books, as well as he writes role-playing games and lots of other things, some comics. And we met Matt at World Fantasy this year, and he and I got to be kind of friendly. And I asked Matt if he would be interested in writing some lyrics to the Angry Robot song. So Matt actually wrote some verses, and he and I co-wrote them. We kind of went back and forth for a couple days writing them, and I did record that. So hopefully that'll be out, and I'm going to put it out totally free this time. And I'm also going to put my covers of the Transformers theme and Mr. Roboto on it, and that will be the Robot EP. So go and check out the Robot EP. Hopefully by the time you're hearing this, it will be out. I have to try to get the work done this week, but that's what I got going this week. So that's about it. And that'll be over at Bandcamp, johnanilio.bandcamp.com. So
does that mean I have a new cover I have to create?
Yes. Yes. I was going to ask you about that. But
okay. Anyway, well, shoot me an email.
I will. So everyone, thanks so much for joining us. It was kind of a long one, but that's okay. And I hope you guys have a great week. And next week, don't even know who we have on. So anyway, it'll be someone good though. Have a great week.
Bye. Thanks.